Hello. Welcome to the Fantastic Fiction at KGB podcast. I'm Rajan Khanna. Fantastic Fiction at KGB is a monthly reading series held on the third Wednesday of every month at the famous KGB bar in Manhattan's East Village. Fantastic Fiction is hosted by Ellen Datlow and Matthew Kressel and features up-and-comers and luminaries in the fields of science fiction, fantasy, and horror. The following audio was recorded live at the KGB bar, so please excuse the various background noises, bumps in the night, and other disturbances that you might hear. It's a live reading in New York City, and anything can and often does happen. And now, on to this month's reading. We hope you enjoy the following recording, and we thank you for listening.
Someone yelling.
We're ready to start. Why is this so weird? That's not usually over there. I'm moving it over. Anyway, you can move wherever you want, but I don't like it that close. Anyway, hi there. Welcome back. At least get me from the top down so you get rid of the chins. Do it. You have to do it the right way, if you can, or otherwise I delete them.
What do you mean by the top down?
No, you just do it. You do it slightly higher than me, and then you. Yeah. You're taller. You're taller. It's really easy. All right, we'll see. They may get deleted or not. Anyway, hi. Welcome back to the second half of Fantastic Fiction at KGB. Thank you. Just a warning that we are running out of money, it turns out. I mean, we did a fundraiser about 2 years ago, three years ago, and the money has been really good. You know, it's lasted this long. And the money is to pay for the writers and pay for dinner for the writers and pay our bartenders a nice tip. And so probably within the next six months, we're trying to figure out what we're going to do next. We decided we're not doing a Patreon. It just doesn't make sense for us for what we do. So we're probably going to try to do a Kickstarter again somehow. And if someone would like to help us, we would really appreciate it because it's a pain in the ass to do a Kickstarter. So if anyone who's really into this kind of thing would like to approach me or Matt and volunteer to help put it together, we'd love it. And we probably won't do it for another 6 months or so, 6 to 8 months, but we do need to do it. So anyway, Mark Laidlaw is our next reader. He's the author of 5 novels, including Dad's Nuke and The 37th Mandala, the latter of which won the International Horror Guild Award. He's been publishing short stories since 1977, appearing in most genre venues, including Omni and the Magazine of Fantasy and Science Fiction. From 1997 to 2016, he is now old enough to be retired. All right. I published his first solo story in Omni, and he was one of those people who you say, I don't want the story, it doesn't work, or it's okay, but it needs work. And he sent it back like 4 times. Yeah. And I finally bought it. You know. Except the next to last one I bought, because the last one he fucked it up. Anyway, he did. Remember? Where are you? Oh, there you are, yes. And that was 400 boys.
Everybody should know this, of course.
Yes, right. Yeah. You don't always do the last revision. Or if you do, we might want you to take it back. Anyway, from 1997 to 2016, he was a lead writer at Valve Software, where he helped create the blockbuster video game series Half-Life and Dota? Dota 2?
Yeah, Dota.
I don't know this stuff. To me, it seems like it should be Data. All right. His latest book is the novella White Spawn from PS Publishing. So please welcome Mark Laidlaw.
Hello. Thank you for coming, everybody. Thank you, Ellen. You mentioned Omni and FNSF. Gordon Van Gelder is over there.
He's our special
two of my favorite editors, people who really had a huge impact on my career. Ellen started out buying my short stories, and Gordon bought my books when I had kind of given up the whole idea of writing altogether. But so they've really helped me out a lot. So hopefully this returns the favor a little bit. I'm going to read 2 things. The first is a short story that just came out today, so hopefully not many people have read it, if anybody. It's at Nightmare Magazine, so if you want to check up later and see if I got any words wrong, you can always go check. So I'll do that first. This is called The Finest, Fullest Flowering. A sour note shrieked from the limousine's speakers, making Milston's fingers curl in his lap. He took a moment to compose himself before rapping precisely and with a now steady hand on the glass separating him from the driver. The tone had droned into a hum that tunelessly dreamt of someday becoming hypnotic. "What is this we're listening to, and is there any way to turn it off?" "Down, sir, but not off, I'm afraid." The driver lowered the volume to a level barely audible. This was in some respects even more annoying. "Part of the colony's ambience, sir, part of the design. Won't be much longer, though, sir, we're almost there." There turned out to be a pale brown stucco bungalow, unremarkable except for the roof of green ceramic tile. From overhead, you might not see it among the trees. Everything here, from the hidden runway to the matte and muted colors of the limousine, bespoke discretion, if not outright camouflage. As he stepped from the car and the driver came around to retrieve his single suitcase and worn black valise from the trunk, he heard the volume of the music increase again, and he realized it was everywhere, moaning from speakers in the trees. There was no turning it down. The sour notes, still plentiful, were also now unavoidable. His luggage was placed on a cart. "Your bags will be waiting for you in your suite. But first, sir, your tour." The driver bowed, ducked back into the limousine, and executed a turn that took the car back toward the airfield. Milston looked about, waiting for a word or direction from the plump older man who stood watchfully by the cart, presumably a concierge. "Am I to meet my patron here?" he asked finally.
"Mr. Milston, it is my great pleasure. Like you, I delight in anonymity. In fact, it has become essential to my survival. Without it, I could never travel, although at this point I rarely leave the island. All my needs are more than met here, as I hope they will be for you. Shall we begin?"
Milston took the proffered hand, found it dry, uncalloused, possessed of a faint tremor. "What am I to call you?" he asked.
"Patron would be perfect. I think you will find me worthy of the title. Nothing would please me more than to support your work. I understand you'll need convincing, but surely you've already looked into my ability to fulfill my promises."
A young woman in a dun uniform emerged from the bungalow to retrieve the cart. The men walked into the trees. They soon came out on a terrace overlooking hectares of manicured parkland. There were more jade-roofed bungalows, but no buildings taller than three stories, nothing that stood above the trees. From the plane, as it descended out of blinding tropical clouds, he had seen breakers and beach on the far side of the island, plenty of room for the patron's playground.
"Everywhere you wander, and I assure you there are no places off-limits, you will come across beauties and wonders. My aim is to provide them in endless profusion. Of course, we are only a decade into the garden by now, barely out of the planning stages."
A small silver car awaited them, an electric capsule mounted on a buried track. The patron urged him in, and once they were seated, the tiny car glided down the sloped terrace. The ubiquitous drone of the music had modulated into something like a faintly complaining whine. The car spread through sculpture gardens and groves where avant-garde topiary trimmers had been at work.
"I will not attempt to impress you with the names of my gardeners. As with many I've hired, the best practitioners are known by name only to the connoisseur. I rely on Cognoscenti to advise me in all things. Which is, of course, how you came to my attention. Your work is the finest in the field, and you're approaching the height of your expressive powers. I hope to provide the opportunity to explore avenues you might never have dared believe could open to you."
The car rolled to a stop at another low, earth-colored villa, this one overlooking a lake. Fans of spray wavered against a backdrop of palms. The air was just warm enough to make the breeze delicious. Inside the house, the music was muted to whatever managed to filter in from outside.
"A home of this sort is what we provide initially," the patron explained. "With time, architectural variety is expected to arise, and you would be encouraged to help design your own ideal accommodations. A great deal of what you see is blank slate, unmolded clay, whatever medium suits you."
They had come out into a room of several stories depth. The ceiling was all glass, flooded with sunlight, the cavernous space below filled with scaffolding. The center of all activity, suspended in the pit, was an enormous black stone over which dozens of artisans scrambled, busy with torches, chisels, drills.
A single iron meteorite, brought here at my expense, that Samira Potocki might pursue her inspiration. It is the heaviest single object ever lifted by air transport. I first had to commission and build a plane powerful enough to carry it, but expenses never hindered me. I liberate my artists to dream as big as they like, or as small. I just completed a STEM lab for the whim of another resident who works at the level of the electron. Few will ever see the work it creates, but that is no longer the point of art, if it ever was. If the audience is properly appreciative, can it matter to the artist if that audience numbers only one? Ah, Samira, meet our latest prospective colonist. She was a small, dark woman in dusty coveralls with sharp features and bright eyes. There is nothing so radiant as an artist fulfilled, the patron said, and her smile supported his statement. Delighted, she said. I hope we will soon be neighbors. What are you working on? He asked, to be polite. I'm not working on, I'm working toward. I offer all my artists the space and resources they need to explore without worrying about arriving anywhere. For Samira, a meteorite. For you, I wonder. I hope to learn what I can offer beyond the obvious supplies. Milston inclined his head, squeezed the sculptor's hand briefly, and was ushered forward. Beyond the space full of scaffolding, outside again, another car waited to carry them deeper into jungle. You can, of course, walk, drive, or be driven, or request any manner of conveyance, the patron assured him. For some, the incubatory process is stimulated by aimless driving, so we've started on construction of a self-contained highway system. There are creative solutions to every need when you have access to sufficient resources. Also, I detected perhaps a bit of a mutual spark between you and Samira. Let me assure you that privacy will be respected and promoted in a way the outside can never approach. My guests can explore any type of relationships they wish without censure. Whatever limits you wish to impose on your own tastes, I leave you to set for yourself. I hazard no guess as to your predilections. Now, from the visual arts to the audible. The building they next approached was a thin spire among the trees, itself a treehouse sheathed in translucent resin mesh. It was awkwardly placed in a scene of such balanced beauty. One of our earliest residents, the patron said. As you can see, he had a hand in his home's design, and while his natural talents are many, in styling himself an architect, I fear he might have finally overreached. Still, I do not like to inhibit my artists. This is all part of his growth. They rode a small cylindrical lift up the trunk of the tower, stepping out onto a circular loft that gave a view toward a view through the trees of distant shore and a misty estuary. Wide white birds glided toward the waves. Seated before the vista, as if controlling it from a vast console of sliders and keys, was a man with long, thinning gray hair. The squawking of the island's ongoing soundtrack grew aggrieved. "Our resident composer," said the patron.
"Why are you disturbing me? Have I not asked you repeatedly to leave me off your tour?"
The composer would not turn around. He treated them to a view of his bald, spotty pate, and that was all.
"In most cases, I have respected that wish," said the patron, "but I felt an exception was necessary."
The patron turned to Milston with an apologetic expression.
"From time to time, I may insist on a patron's privilege. I trust I know better than to abuse it. Consider that we only come to admire the view."
"Well, you've seen it. Now be off."
"I have been enjoying your latest compositions very much, I should mention," said the patron with apparent sincerity.
The bony white fingers paused on the keyboard.
"I am told that in certain of the residences, speakers have been disabled."
The air trembled with an extended note not quite of melancholy, not quite of anything specific enough to characterize. Milston found himself staring at the poorly manicured fingers, the ragged, bitten nails, like visual equivalents of the sounds that had accompanied his tour. "A pleasure meeting you," he said, but there was no verbal reply from the composer, just another misplaced warble, a sonic non sequitur that sent the birds from the trees. From the treehouse, they proceeded to a vast kitchen complex, where chefs with names he almost recognized ordered about kitchen staff of only slightly lesser celebrity. Lunch was served above the waves on an enclosed pier from which he could look back toward the island or out toward the undisturbed horizon. Each dish was a revelation.
"Imagine such miracles at every meal," the patron said, "and in every aspect of your life and work. Does it tempt you? There is much more still to see, but I wonder what you think so far.
You are persuasive, Milston allowed himself to say.
Well, it is not I alone. It is the Enterprise. What we have here is a place that allows the fullest, finest flowering of human endeavor in all its variety. The arts are permitted to come into their own, and what I get out of all this is something I cannot describe. To be patron. There is no greater honor or pleasure. Now, shall we go? There are others to meet. A tiny portion of our residence, but it should give you a taste of all you'll have access to. Ultimately, our greatest resource is the community we're gathering.
Before we continue, I just want to clarify the one stipulation that I'm sure has been a sticking point for many before me. The fact that
you can never leave.
That one, yes.
Our residents find security and certainty. I can bring anything I like here to the island, but nothing gets out. Nothing and no one. A prison, some have called it, but one that allows for utter freedom of expression. I should think you especially would find this liberating, given that your own work has been so restricted, curtailed, and banned outright.
What about the rest of the world? Don't you wonder if you're robbing them of something essential, something they might miss?
Does the world deserve them, Mr. Milston? Would that world miss you?
Milston, sitting very still, said nothing more.
Shall we?
They rose and walked along the pier, once more back to a silent silver capsule. The rest of the day was spent in the company of an extraordinary variety of extraordinary people, poets, painters, planners, programmers. At sunset, they joined a party being held in a plaza by the sea. Milston mingled and the patron disappeared, but Samira soon found him and introduced him to still more of the colony's residents. The composer did not attend the fete, but he was there in spirit with a brooding score that made them all laugh, eliciting frequent snide remarks.
"Please tell me you're a new composer," said an elderly woman with reflective pupils,
but then she stopped his mouth with a finger.
"No, don't. For now, let us leave some mystery. There's little enough of that here, though each new arrival brings the hope of it."
And she gave him a wine-soaked kiss with an expertly placed but feeble grasp at his crotch, which cost him nothing to endure. It was full tropic dark, but still early, when the patron found him in the crowd and pulled him aside once more.
"Mr. Milston, I have given you a full day of my time. This is all I can offer a prospective resident, I'm afraid. In the morning, we either put you on a plane and you never hear from me again, or you wake to begin your new life here. If the former, I very much enjoyed meeting you, and I regret but respect your decision. If the latter, then you may sleep in as late as you wish. There will be plenty of time for further orientation, and I promise you I will enjoy following your work and look forward to learning from the master. Now, your suite is ready if you are."
They rode a silver car in silence through a landscape of artfully illuminated fountains and pools. Guests walked among the trees, watching the car pass, as if wondering what choice he had reached. But there had never really been any choice to make. When the car stopped before the bungalow where the day's tour had begun, he shook the patron's hand and said, "I appear to be jet-lagged. Apologies if I have not been quite myself. I'm sure I'll feel better after a night's rest. Can we meet again sometime tomorrow afternoon?"
"Perfect," said the patron. "I'll leave instructions that you are not to be disturbed. Good night, and welcome. You've made a splendid choice."
The silver car whispered away. The house was small, but it had all the comforts and conveniences. He unpacked his suitcases and put his clothes away, found a bottle of very old whiskey and a box of very young cigars, but these were not what tempted him. He went out onto the terrace and gazed over the gardens. He was braced and waiting for the aimless soundtrack to make one more offensive squawk when suddenly it stopped. The sounds of island night crept in. It was bliss. The landscape was sparingly painted with light, evocative as a dream. He saw hints of buildings through the trees, the glow of ornamental ponds, white coral pillars, miles and miles of gardens, a distant spire that must have belonged to the composer, now retired for the night. In the absence of music, he felt he could finally think, could finally imagine what might take its place, what this garden truly needed. The finest, fullest flowering, the patron had stated, and indeed it was true. The place was in full bloom, but every garden needed pruning, and a blossom deserved to be lopped before its prime had passed, before its petals fell. He set his black bag on the table, thinking of tools he had always wanted but never bothered to acquire, never daring to think he might get to use them, but that could come later, For now, he had all he needed to get started. He took out his prized set of shears, edges gleaming, of pristine surgical steel. I'll begin with that composer's horrible, hideous, ragged-nailed fingers, he thought, looking off toward the dark house of sound, imagining notes that were very sweet indeed. The end.
Thank you, thank you.
Siri, not available. Okay, the next thing I'm going to read. Oh, so that came out today in Nightmare Magazine. So it's got to escape the paywall earlier, so it's there. The next thing is a work in progress, and has a little bit of a story behind it. Both of my daughters had to read Frankenstein in high school or junior high. Both of them were very excited to do so, and then extremely disappointed when they actually got into it. If you haven't looked at Frankenstein in a while, at least the first 20 pages or so are letters between characters who aren't in the story and vaguely related to it. And they both seemed to feel they were expecting monsters, I guess. So after this happened the second time, I kind of hatched an idea of doing something I call Frankenstein with actual monsters. So, armed with, I guess it's the Gutenberg.org edition of Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, I've been slowly adding monsters to Frankenstein. At least one monster per paragraph. This is our guarantee. So I'm going to read the first letter. So most of this obviously is Mary Shelley, and a little bit is me. And it was inspired by something called Fucking Dracula, which you can find on Amazon, but somebody just went through Dracula and added the word fucking almost everywhere. And they came so close, but they didn't really go for the comic timing. They just sort of hit a macro and added Frankenstein. So I always felt like, oh, so close. So this was my attempt to get a little closer. Letter 1. St. Petersburg, December 11th, 17, whatever. To Mrs. Seville, England. You will rejoice to hear that no disaster has accompanied the commencement of an enterprise which you have regarded with such evil forebodings. I arrived here yesterday, and my first task is to assure my dear sister of my welfare and increasing confidence in the success of my undertaking and the absolute lack of any monsters that she need worry about. I am already far north of London, and as I walk in the streets of Petersburg, I feel a cold northern breeze play upon my cheeks, which braces my nerves and fills me with delight. Do you understand this feeling? This breeze, which has traveled from the regions towards which I am advancing, gives me a foretaste of those icy climes. Inspirited by this wind of promise, my daydreams become more fervent and vivid. I picture Dracula mooning himself beneath a silvery orb, mummies and wolfmen ply me with Italian ices. I try in vain to be persuaded that the pole is a seat of frost and desolation. It ever presents itself to my imagination as the region of beauty and delight. There, Margaret, the sun is forever visible, its broad disk just skirting the horizon and diffusing a perpetual splendor. There, for with your leave, my sister, I will put some trust in preceding navigators. There, snow and frost and hideous creatures out of nightmare are banished. And sailing over a calm sea, we may be wafted to a land surpassing in wonders and in beauty every region hitherto discovered on the habitable globe. Its productions and features may be without example, as the phenomena of the heavenly bodies undoubtedly are in those undiscovered solitudes. What may not be expected in a country of eternal light other than a total lack of vampires? I may there discover the wondrous power which attracts the needle, repels bloodsuckers, and may regulate 1,000 celestial observations that require only this voyage to render their seeming eccentricities consistent forever. I shall satiate my ardent curiosity with a sight of a part of the world never before visited, and may tread a land never before imprinted by the foot of man or vampire. These are my enticements, and they are sufficient to conquer all fear of danger or death or undead, and to induce me to commence this laborious voyage with the joy a child feels when he embarks in a little boat with his holiday mates on an expedition of discovery up his native river. But supposing all these conjectures to be false, You cannot contest the inestimable benefit which I shall confer on all mankind to the last generation by discovering a passage near the pole to those countries, to reach which at present so many months are requisite, or by ascertaining the secret of the magnet, which, if at all possible, can only be effected by an undertaking such as mine. These reflections have dispelled the agitation with which I began my letter, and I feel my heart glow with an enthusiasm which elevates me to heaven, for nothing contributes so much to tranquilize the mind as a steady purpose, a point on which the soul may fix its intellectual eye. This expedition has been the favorite dream of my early years to counteract my childish nightmares. I have read with ardor the accounts of the various voyages which have been made in the prospect of arriving at the North Pacific Ocean through the seas which surround the pole. You may remember that a history of all the voyages made for purposes of discovery composed the whole of our good Uncle Thomas's library, except for those small dioramas featuring monsters in various threatening poses. My education was neglected, yet I was passionately fond of reading. These volumes were my study day and night, and my familiarity with them increased that regret which I had felt as a child on learning that my father's dying injunction, a curse lifted from the Necronomicon, had forbidden my uncle to allow me to embark in a seafaring life. There's more tedium yet to come, I assure you. 6 years have passed since I resolved on my present undertaking, which makes me, in a sense, an undertaker. I can even now remember the hour from which I dedicated myself to this great enterprise. I commenced by inuring my body to hardship. I accompanied the whale fishers on several expeditions to the North Sea. I feasted on the dead. I voluntarily endured cold, famine, thirst, want of sleep, and Sasquatch attack. I often worked harder than the common sailors during the day and devoted my nights to the study of mathematics, the theory of medicine, and those branches of physical science from which a naval adventurer might derive the greatest practical advantage, and monstrology. Twice I actually hired myself as an undermate in a Greenland whaler and acquitted myself to admiration. I must own I felt a little proud when my captain offered me the second dignity in the vessel and entreated me to remain with the greatest earnestness, so valuable did he consider my services. And now, dear Margaret, do I not deserve to accomplish some great purpose? My life might have been passed in ease and luxury, but I preferred glory and monster stalking to every enticement that wealth placed in my path. Oh, that some encouraging voice would answer in the affirmative. My courage and my resolution is firm, but my hopes fluctuate, and my spirits are often depressed. I am about to proceed on a long and difficult voyage, the emergencies of which, and the spectral haunts which will no doubt trouble the ship, will demand all my fortitude. I am required not only to raise the spirits of others, but sometimes to sustain my own when theirs are falling. I am also sometimes required to raise the spirits of the dead, and the flesh of them as well. This is the most favorable period for traveling in Russia. They, the people, not the bayaki or vampire bats, fly quickly over the snow in their sledges. The motion is pleasant, and in my opinion, far more agreeable than that of an English stagecoach. The cold is not excessive if you are wrapped in furs, a dress which I have already adopted, for there is a great difference between walking the deck and remaining seated motionless for hours, when no exercise prevents the blood from actually freezing in your veins, though that might foil the action of certain predatory creatures of the night. I have no ambition to lose my life on the post road between St. Petersburg and Archangel, or even Archdevil. I shall depart for the latter town in a fortnight or 3 weeks, and my intention is to hire a ship there, which can easily be done by paying the insurance for the owner, and to engage as many sailors as I think necessary among those who are accustomed to the whale fishing. I do not intend to sail until the month of June, and when shall I return? Ah, dear sister, how can I answer this question? If I succeed, many, many months, perhaps years will pass before you and I may meet. If I fail, you will see me again soon or never. Farewell, my dear, excellent monster, I mean Margaret. Heaven shower down blessings on you, hell fling them upward, and save me that I may again and again testify my gratitude for all your love and kindness. Your affectionate brother, not a monster, I swear by God, and not the God of monsters, but the regular God, R. Walton. Thank you.
very much. That was great. And I hope to see you next month. And you can hang out and drink. Or I think there are how many books are left? Come on, don't let... Five. Don't let Daniel Tate have to take those home. Come on, buy them and let him sign them.
You have been listening to the Fantastic Fiction at KGB podcast, recorded live at the KGB Bar. We hope you enjoyed what you heard, and we thank you for listening. We also wish to thank Gordon Linzer for providing the audio, and Rajan Khanna, that's me, for the introduction and farewell. And always, thanks to our many fans of Fantastic Fiction at KGB for supporting us all these years. See you next month.